From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we're keeping tabs on the latest reports that investigators believe the component number on recovered airplane debris found on an island in the Indian Ocean comes from a 777 aircraft.
And there is only one of those missing.
There's only one of those missing. Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. We're still waiting to figure out if it is indeed from that plane.
But we're going to start with that proposed Iran nuclear deal to limit Iran's ability to develop a nuclear weapon. Secretary of State John Kerry recently told the House Foreign Affairs Committee there would be consequences if Congress rejects the deal.
You'll not only be giving Iran a free pass to double the pace of its uranium enrichment, but they will do it without the unprecedented inspection and transparency measures that we've secured.
Well, there are critics of the deal, but also our next guest says there's something of a mini conventional arms race going on because of it. Marcus Weisgerber is with Defense One. Marcus, what do you mean an arms race?
Well, there's been a sort of arms race going on in the Middle East for about 10 years now. The Middle Eastern countries have all been afraid of Iran. They've been afraid of the nuclear program. They've been afraid of its missiles. And they've been buying stuff. They've been buying fighter jets. They've been buying tanks and armored vehicles. And one thing they're buying a lot of is missile defense equipment, stuff like the Patriot missile, which gained a lot of popularity back during the Gulf War in 1991 for intercepting Saddam's Scuds.
You speak to missile defense experts who say this, they saw this coming.
They did. The Iranian nuclear program, while it is going to be limited under this deal, sanctions on conventional weapon sales come off in about 5 years, and sanctions on their missile program come off in about 8 years. So what that means is countries need time to procure these missile interceptors. So what you're doing is you're starting to see that already.
Yeah. Well, and remind us why countries in the region are that concerned. This is a tightly packed region.
Iran has lots of sophisticated missiles. They have all types of missiles, from cruise missiles, which can fly low and are tough to detect with radar, to longer range weapons. What the Patriot does is the Patriot specifically can intercept all types of those missiles. And what you're doing is you're seeing, and most recently with Saudi yesterday, the State Department said, it's okay, we'll allow you to purchase 600 of the newest Patriot missiles.
Well, and one of the concerns is that countries like Saudi Arabia, which, as you say, just was given the green light to buy 600 Patriot missile interceptors, they have about, what, 4 minutes to act if Iran fires?
They don't have much time at all. Like you said, yes, about four minutes. One of the big problems they have is each of these countries, you have Saudi Arabia, you have United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Kuwait, they all have Patriot or other types of missile defense systems. The problem is they don't talk to each other. The fear is that if Iran launches a weapon, say, at Saudi Arabia and it travels over UAE or travels over Qatar, all these countries may start firing their missile interceptors, which could perhaps prevent them from actually striking the missile that's coming in.
Well, and maybe striking each other.
Correct.
Yeah. But meanwhile, what is your thinking of how this plays out?
Over the next 5 years, they're expected to spend about $500 billion on defense and about $165 billion of which on new weapons. Qatar is buying, or wants to buy, let's say, a giant radar. It's about 13 stories tall. It could detect missiles over 3,000 miles away.
Well, so there's concern that Iran may not abide by the deal and develop a nuclear weapon, but also concern, as we're hearing, about Iran's conventional weapons. A vote on the Iran deal by Congress is anticipated in September. President Obama has threatened to veto any resolution rejecting the deal. Do you think concern about conventional weapons and this arms buildup that you're watching will be enough to be the thing to make Congress vote against it?
It won't, because Congress has been very complacent in allowing these countries to purchase conventional weapons over the past 10 years or so. And specifically, these countries are contributing right now in the airstrike campaign against ISIS, both in Iraq and Syria. So you're going to see them, in addition to buying these types of missile defenses and stuff specifically for Iran, they're going to be replenishing the equipment that they're using for these airstrikes. So because they've been so supportive of this, you're going to see this go right through Congress.
By the way, are most of these systems and weapons being bought from American defense companies?
The majority are, yes. You're seeing European companies get in there more. But the fact of the matter is U.S. systems are many times superior to the other stuff out there on the market.
And so American companies represented by these American lawmakers are benefiting from this.
You bet they are. Everyone's been happy about this in the defense community because it's offsetting a decline in U.S. defense spending.
That's Marcus Weisgerber, global business reporter for Defense One. Marcus, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, now to the discovery of that piece of airline debris found near Madagascar on Reunion Island in the Indian Ocean. It appears that the debris is from a Boeing 777, and authorities are now trying to determine if it's from the missing Boeing 777 that disappeared 509 days ago. Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 went missing after taking off from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, en route to Beijing. There were 239 people aboard. If the debris is from MH370, it will give a boost to the theory that it went down in the Indian Ocean, which has been the focus of the search for more than a year. The question of why it went down will remain, and we have heard a lot of answers to that question on this program. Starting on March 11th, 2014, 3 days after the plane disappeared, when former pilot Mark Weiss spoke with us.
Did somebody come into the cockpit? Did somebody who was in the cockpit try to wrestle that airplane away from the pilots? Did one of the pilots have a meltdown? Certainly, there seems to have been enough time for word to have gotten out from the cockpit, if word had wanted to be gotten out, that they had deviated from their flight path. And that's disturbing, and it should be disturbing to anybody.
The next day, we heard from former Transportation Department Inspector General Mary Schiavo, who suspected cracking in the fuselage.
The most sensible, given what we know, which isn't very much, is that it had a rapid decompression. It lost the ability to communicate with this transponder. Not that it was turned off voluntarily or hijacked, but the signal was no longer being sent out. Mm. And then they continued on. Why? Because that's what the 777 does. The 777 is a really pretty cool plane. So is the Airbus 340. I don't mean to slight Airbus. But the 777 has a system like the Airbus where when something goes wrong, the plane itself will start shutting down unnecessary systems. It shuts down unnecessary communication systems. It shuts down everything, basically. It will spool down system by system until what's left? Control surfaces, left, right, up, down, and the engines. The 777 will fight to save itself, and yeah. I think that's what it did.
The day after that, March 13th, 2014, we heard from Wall Street Journal reporter Andy Pastor, who suggested that the plane may have landed somewhere.
It's increasingly clear to these investigators that something really weird and bizarre happened in the cockpit and that this plane did not fall out of the sky when it dropped off the radar scopes.
When you say that it landed, you mean that it landed, not that it crash-landed, but that it landed on a runway?
This is the increasingly complex and in some ways unbelievable scenario that investigators are putting together. Yes, that it landed on some runway. Now, we have to say that it's not clear where it is currently, whether it crashed eventually or whether it landed somewhere, and what its current state is. But the consensus is that the plane did not crash when it dropped off the radar scopes, and it remained intact and probably flew for up to 4 hours.
That idea that the plane landed was one that intrigued one of the people who spent hours on TV trying to explain what happened to MH370, Jeff Wise, who laid out his theory to us on February 25th of this year.
The data that remains that I think is pretty much incorruptible by itself gives a pretty good idea of where the plane went, and it's hard to arrive at any place other than Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan obviously is a Russian ally. In fact, within Kazakhstan, pretty close to where the route probably wound up, you have a place called Baikonur, which is the famous cosmodrome from which manned space launches take place. And on this, in this oval of territory that's leased by Russia from Kazakhstan, there's a great big airstrip that sat largely disused for the last 30 years or so. And I argue that this could be a potential place where the plane might have gone. Whether it's Russia or Kazakhstan, you're looking essentially, this is either Russia or a Russian ally.
I've heard every theory, some of which are barking mad, some of which are just dishonest, and some of this are just unrealistic.
CNN analyst Richard Quest from our conversation with him on March 18th, 2014.
On the one hand, either the pilots or somebody else took control of the aircraft for nefarious means, and it's crashed or it's somewhere. But on the other side of the spectrum, you have a mechanical fault or you have a serious issue with the aircraft, which ultimately overwhelms the pilots and the plane crashes. Now, I have seen nothing in the evidence of what we've been told that leads me one way or the other. But don't be fooled by what you've heard. You've heard the Malaysian authorities talk about deliberate acts. And I keep coming back to this argument again and again. Yes, the plane turned round. But did it turn round at the point of a gun? Or did it turn round because the captain, realising there was a major fault or there was something dramatically wrong with his aircraft, tried to turn back to get back to Kuala Lumpur, to get back to ground? We don't know.
And remember, we still don't know whether that piece of debris found on an island in the Indian Ocean is from MH370, but we'll keep following this story.
Former University of Cincinnati police officer Ray Tenzing pled not guilty this morning in a Hamilton County courtroom. He was fired after he was charged with murder yesterday in the shooting death of Samuel DeBose, who was driving near the campus July 19th when Tenzing pulled him over for not having a front license plate. A police body cam shows it escalated to the fatal shooting within seconds. Here's Hamilton County prosecuting attorney Joe Dieters yesterday.
This just does not happen in the United States. People don't get shot for a traffic stop, unless they're violent towards the police officer. And he wasn't.
Dieters also called the shooting senseless and asinine. But this is another in a string of incidents in which the victims were African-American, the officers white. And it's at a time when African-Americans are also looking at changes in voting laws, at the shooting deaths of churchgoers. In fact, next month, the NAACP is organizing a march called America's Journey for Justice, 860 miles from Selma to Washington, D.C., to call attention to current issues. Cornell William Brooks is president and CEO of the NAACP, and he joins us now. President Brooks, thanks for being with us.
It is a delight to be here and great to be in conversation with you.
Well, thank you. And your thoughts first on Cincinnati and this seemingly swift response to the incident there.
Well, on behalf of the family of the NAACP, we extend our deepest sympathies to the family of Mr. DeBose. We are heartened by this yet tragic indictment of this officer. The reason being is here we have a father of 10 on the eve of an engagement who is pulled over in a routine traffic stop, and he is, in effect, executed on dash cam. It can't be that we apply the death penalty for routine traffic stops. In any event, this is represents excessive use of force.
Is it, though, racist?
Well, where we find that African-American men are 21 times more likely to lose their lives at the hands of police than their white counterparts, if it is not racist, it is certainly racially disproportionate and racially disparate. But in any event, it is certainly troubling to Americans of any hue and any heritage because this runs counter to our highest constitutional and moral values.
Well, I'll talk more about what you'd like to see happen because there was a dash cam in the case of Samuel DeBose. That's why we know what happened. There was a dash cam in the case of Sandra Bland, who was pulled over after she allegedly failed to signal while changing lanes. And that also escalated into a weekend arrest. And then she was then found hung in her jail cell. There were cameras. People are getting to see. So let's stay there for a second.
That's right.
White Americans, many of them are having conversations and saying, well, gee, I don't think I would have been pulled over for not signaling. So that is happening. Do you see that as a positive?
Well, yes. To the degree that we speak to one another's humanity, when we begin to empathize with one another and say to ourselves, if I were in that situation, how would I be treated? Does it matter if my heart is wrapped in black skin or brown skin? Or white skin, as citizens under the same Constitution, aren't we entitled to fair and equal treatment? Americans from all across the length and breadth of this country, when you consider these facts, consider this unrelenting stream of tragedies from Michael Brown to Tamir Rice to Sandy Bland, we have to ask ourselves, can't we do better? And the answer to that question is yes. There are police departments that do it better.
I want to ask you how you get to that, because as we said, even with the dash cams, these things are still happening. The good news is that people are seeing them. But in the meantime, tougher question maybe, is there any message maybe you'd like to deliver to the African-American community? Because there are also some watching these incidents and saying, well, why did they resist? Or why did they, let's say, badmouth a cop who was asking them to put out a cigarette? Or in the case of Mr. DuBose, why didn't they just open the door and take off the seatbelt as asked? Is there any conversation there?
Well, the NAACP, we have a document called the 411 on the 50, which provides advice, particularly to young people, on how to interact with the police if they are stopped or detained. And we have, of course, encouraged people to interact with police officers in a civil, polite fashion, and yet be aware of their rights. But I want to pose this question to you. Where in the Constitution does it prescribe the death penalty for discourteous behavior? I mean, the reality here is police officers are charged with protecting people, whether or not they're courteous, whether they've had a good day or a bad day. And so smoking a cigarette should not subject you to be threatened to being tased.
Well, and the overwhelming consensus is that this was unnecessary escalation on the part of the police in these two cases. And so what would you like to see? Because the African-American community still needs policing, so as all communities do. So what would you like to see happen there?
Well, what we'd like to see happen here is effective training of police officers in de-escalation techniques, number one. Number two, that police officers are trained to encourage community trust rather than precipitating distrust. Three, that police officers are trained not to profile and to use evidence-based policing. The very reforms that we're calling for are represented in federal legislation, in the In Racial Profiling Act, in the Law Enforcement Integrity Act, currently waiting in Congress to be passed, which is why the NAACP, standing with so many others, including those in law enforcement. And this is precisely why, you know, we've announced America's Journey for Justice, because we're trying to create a grassroots movement for real reform when it comes to policing.
Well, you're also hoping, we understand, at least some members are, to resurrect a part of the 1965 Voting Rights Act that was struck down by the Supreme Court in 2013. Let's talk about that point of the march. This is the pre-clearance provision. It required states with a history of voting discrimination to get federal approval before they made any changes to their election procedures. As we said, it was struck down. There are states that are changing their voting procedures. What are your concerns there?
Well, here are concerns. In the wake of the Shelby versus Holder Supreme Court decision in 2013, Section 4B of the Voting Rights Act was essentially gutted. And what that meant was the Voting Rights Act, which is widely regarded as the most effective civil rights statute, and Section 5, which was regarded as the most effective section of the statute, were nullified. If not nullified, then certainly greatly weakened. Now, what's happened? We've seen state legislature after state legislature all across this country enact laws which have made it harder to vote, which have erected barriers at the voting booth. When you end same-day voter registration, early registration, where you make it harder for young people to vote, there may be some partisan advantage in that, but there is a great deal of racial disadvantage in that. Our challenge in this country is not preventing people from voting in order to ensure that there's no voter fraud. Our problem is encouraging people to vote because not enough people do vote.
Well, Cornell Williams-Brooks, again, president of the NAACP, I don't think there's any question that America is in the middle of a race moment over the last year. On the one hand, through dash cameras and home videos, we're being made aware of discrimination against African Americans in interactions with the police force. On the other hand, as you say and others say, African Americans feel they're seeing their voting rights erode. So what moment is this?
Well, this is a moment that by any measure is a moment for the country. I would note that there were people of a variety of backgrounds that literally gave their lives for the right to vote. When we see Latinos denied their right to vote, when we see rural voters finding it more difficult to vote, seniors and people with disabilities finding it more difficult to vote, that's a bad moment for America. So we are in the midst, I believe, of a millennial civil rights movement.
And one last question. What would you say to young people who might say, NAACP, my parents were in that. I have social media now.
Sure.
Why a march? Who walks anymore? You just go to your computer. What would you say to young people?
What I would say to any young person, what I would say to my sons who are 15 and 18, one can tweet and make a social injustice known, but to transform a social injustice into a social justice moment, you have to have boots on the ground in order to enact and put laws on the books. To do that, that means showing up. That means marching from Selma to Washington, D.C., showing up in the halls of Congress and pushing for reform. We can't tweet our way to a better America. We can march our way to a better America. We can vote our way to a better America. We can stand against, but we have to be clear. Democracy is not a spectator sport. You got to be on the field.
President Brooks, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
Cornell William Brooks is president and CEO of the NAACP. We'll link you to information about their march, America's Journey for Justice, over 800 miles from August 1st through September 15th, Selma to Washington, D.C. And by the way, let us know if you are planning on going. Leave a comment at hereandnow.org. And by the way, while there, our other View from the Top conversations with America's different leaders is also archived, hereandnow.org. The fantasy sports business is booming. Websites like DraftKings collect millions in online bets every day.
Listen up, people. Playing fantasy sports doesn't have to be a season-long commitment. Experience the thrill of watching your team of hand-drafted players earn you points and win you real cash whenever you want.
Professional sports leagues and the television networks that televise them are paying attention. They're also paying. Fox Sports and other investors pumped $300 million into DraftKings this week. And that site's chief rival, FanDuel, got $275 million from NBC Sports and Time Warner's Turner Sports and other investors. Mike Pesca is Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the podcast The Gist at Slate.com and joins us now. Mike, I'm clueless here.
Uh-huh.
Is this like fantasy teams where you have your own teams? How does it work?
Yes. So years and years, decades ago, the idea of fantasy sports was born, rotisserie baseball, especially by Dan Uckrent and a couple of other writers. Hey, let's draft a player, and depending on how that player does, we'll assign him to our pretend team. He hits a home run. Our team gets credited with a home run. End of the season, guy with the most home runs win. That's very basic. So from there, it metastasized and exploded until now. You can play in a league, quote unquote, that lasts all of a day or an afternoon. And these sites, as you say, their valuations, when you look at how much big companies like Disney's paying for, you know, some of these sites are worth $1 billion. That's how much revenue they're bringing in.
Well, and it's legal. But why is it legal? Because technically, isn't betting on sports illegal outside of Nevada?
Right.
Nevada.
So in some states, Arizona, Montana, Louisiana, Iowa, and Washington, just off the top of my head, it's quasi-legal or not legal. But the general principle is that these are considered acts of skill. It takes insight and acumen to determine which players you put on your team, as opposed to sports of luck. But the real answer is that when the government defines what is legal, what is illegal, what's an act of skill and luck, there's a lot of lobbying involved. So when New Jersey wanted to have some legalized sports gambling, the leagues, like the NFL, interceded and said, no way. The NBA, by the way, is in favor of some form of legalized gambling. But since these leagues are now partners and making a lot of money off fantasy sports, they're not going to stand in the way of the legality. It's making money for them. So there's not a lot of opposition to it being illegal. So that's why it's considered legal.
Well, and why are TV networks investing? What's in it for them?
Well, think about it. I mean, I'm a Jets fan. My team's eliminated by week five most weeks, most years. So why am I going to tune in? And, you know, getting the male viewer is demographically, advertisers want to reach them. They're a gold mine. Plus, everything's TiVo'd except live sports. It's a confluence of everything that TV is about, to hook male viewers with a vested interest, even when games aren't inherently dramatic. Two teams eliminated from the playoffs. or let's say it's a 10-0 blowout game, you might tune in until the eighth inning if your guy's going to get an at-bat to see if your guy hits a home run.
Right, and as you said, that's what you're calculating, how many home runs hit. You play. What does it feel like? Just a few seconds.
I've been playing since 1982. I was 9 years old, and it's great because you could outsmart a GM or at least your 10 other friends. And if you know that Troy Tulowitzki is going to have 15 home runs instead of 35, you make a little money on that.
Well, you can.
I can.
That's Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And we now know makes a little money on the side. Mike, thank you.
Or loses.
It's Here and Now.
It's Here and Now, and it's time for the DJ sessions. And there goes the last DJ. Joining us now is Raul Campos, who is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. Raul, great to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
And let's get right to some of the music that you brought. This is Uno by the Chilean group Astro. So, Raul, tell us what we're hearing here.
Astro is a crew coming out of Santiago, Chile, and it's from their follow-up album called Chicos de la Luz, Kids of the Light or of the Sun. And it's such a warm kind of new disco, indie dance vibe that they've embraced. And the whole scene coming out of Santiago, Chile these days is absolutely fantastic with people like Alex Anwanter, Latin Bitman, DJ Raph, and many, many others. It's really cool vibes coming out of Santiago.
It's interesting because I don't hear a lot of Chilean musicians that make it into the mainstream of music in this country.
Yeah, they're actually doing really well. They're on Nacional Records, which is a label kind of that really pushes the Latin alternative. They're really involved with things like the Latin Alternative Music Conference that just happened in July in New York. And they were out there, and they performed at a beautiful venue in Brooklyn called Prospect Park.
Yeah.
And it's outdoors. It's amazing. And they played with an Argentine band called Los Auténticos Decadentes and the Mexican rockers Kinky. And it was just jam-packed. It was amazing.
Wow, the Chileans and the Argentinians coming together and not fighting with each other?
No, you know, it was kind of a trip because you're out there, and I get to host this conference year after year and go to all these different venues and just kind of see what the crowd's responding to. And, you know, you go up there and you say, oh, who's here from, you know, supporting Chile? You know, you get the crowd, you get then the Argentines going crazy, you get the Mexicans going crazy. So it's always just a fun time.
All right, well, let's get to another one. This is the British electronic dance group The Chemical Brothers featuring Beck with Wide Open. Very different sound there, Raul, and I really like that. That's a song that I would buy.
It's absolutely amazing. Wide Open with Beck on the vocals. You can't go wrong there. The Chemical Brothers. I'm a big, big, big fan of actually buying music, and whether it's a vinyl, a CD, or even a digital file.
I know, although it does seem like it's getting so much easier these days to just pay a subscription fee and not buy the music, but there is something nice about owning it.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm totally into the nostalgia of having liner notes and a physical product.
Well, and tell us about the album. This is off the Chemical Brothers' new album.
Yeah, it's called Born in the Echoes, and the great collaborations that they have. You know, Kate Le Bon's on the title track. They have Q-Tip again on one of the other tunes. And they just kind of straddle this fine line of what's like pop and dance music and progressive electronica beats. So it's cool to see that they still have these great collaborations. I mean, they've done stuff back in the day with like Wayne Coyne of Flaming Lips. Who else? Noel Gallagher, Beth Orton, so many.
Well, next let's go to Israel and the Israeli musician Kudiman. This is Intergalactic Lovers.
If I've been on your mind since that time when we took off for the stars, we are
I really like what's going on in the background there with the instruments.
Totally. Well, I don't know how familiar you are with Kudiman, but I've been a fan of this guy for years because the music that he's done like prior is he takes YouTube videos and he just kind of splices them together to get the arrangements and some of the instrumentation for a lot of his tracks. And on this one, he's linked up with this website called Fiverr.com, Fiverr.com, where you can actually source out musicians and singers and collaborate with people all over the world. And so that's basically what he's done. He's linked up with, like, I think it's maybe like 20-some musicians around the world, like from 12 different countries, and has pieced together this track called Intergalactic Lovers. And you can check it out on the site, get more information.
All right, well, one more we have time for here, and this is returning back to Latin America where we started this DJ session, back to Mexico, with the artist Natalia Lafourcade, who has this song called Hasta la Raíz.
Cuando escriba tu nombre en la arena blanca con fondo azul, cuando mire el cielo en la forma cruel de una nube gris, aparezcas tú. Una tarde subo una alta loma, mire el pasado, sabrás que no te he olvidado. Yo te llevo dentro hasta la raíz, y por más que crezca, vas a estar aquí, aunque yo me oculte.
A very sweet sound there, Raul. Who is Natalia Lafourcade?
She is a beautiful singer-songwriter from the southern eastern part of Mexico called Veracruz, Coatepec to be exact. And she does have this kind of sweet, just the pretty sound. And she, too, is a fantastic musician. She plays keyboards, guitar, obviously sings. She's also an actress in Mexico. So she's been around for quite some time, and she's making a lot of noise. She just performed recently here in downtown Los Angeles. Sold-out crowd at the beautiful Regent Theater in downtown. It's one of the many theaters that have been beautifully restored. So it was cool to see that.
And how come this stuff doesn't make it into the top of the charts like the Enrique Iglesias or, you know, Ricky Martin or people like that?
You know, most of these artists are independent and they're signed either to very small labels or no labels at all. In this case, I mean, she's with Sony Music coming out of Mexico. So we're expecting big things for Natalia because she is definitely doing some great shows around the country, around the world. But, you know, it is an alternative sound. It's a little bit more underground. It's not your traditional, you know, like you said, Enrique Iglesias or Juanes or somebody like that. You know, there's nothing wrong with that sound. They are fantastic performers, great musicians, great music that they put out. But, you know, it in these days, it's tough to get onto the mainstream radio. As you know, it takes a lot of money, it takes a lot of effort, and for an independent artist, it's tough to break through. But, you know, Natalia is definitely on her way, so we're looking forward to seeing her really become what she is definitely capable, even though she's already been around for close to, 15 years or so.
Raul Campos, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. Raul, thank you so much as always.
Thank you. Appreciate it, J-Hub.
And you can get all of our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. That's on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music. And you can find the names of these songs at hereandnow.org. It's Here and Now, and a quick note now on something that happened 50 years ago today and almost certainly affects you or someone you know. On July 30th, 1965, President Lyndon Johnson signed legislation establishing Medicare and Medicaid, Medicare being government health coverage for senior citizens and Medicaid being government health coverage for the poor.
No longer will older Americans be denied the healing miracle of modern medicine. No longer will illness crush and destroy the savings that they have so carefully put away over a lifetime so that they might enjoy dignity in their later years.
Well, as Morning Edition noted today, the American Medical Association campaigned against it and enlisted an actor by the name of Ronald Reagan.
Write those letters now. Call your friends and tell them to write them. If you don't, this program, I promise you, will pass just as surely as the sun will come up tomorrow. And behind it will come other federal programs that will invade every area of freedom as we have known it in this country. Until one day, as Norman Thomas said, we will awake to find that we have socialism.
Well, today, in 2015, there are more than 52 million Americans on Medicare, and 31 million low-income Americans are covered by Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP.
Another anniversary to mark. Seven veterans of the World War II in the Pacific Northwest are heading to Tokyo today, carrying seven captured Japanese flags to return them for the 70th anniversary of the end of the war. Tom Bonsi reports on a journey rich with symbolism, but one that may bankrupt its organizers.
It's been nearly 70 years since Dallas Britt last set foot in Japan. Back then, he was a battle-hardened infantryman in the U.S. Army's occupation force. Britt did manage to learn a few words of Japanese and a children's song.
It goes like this. Ami ami hoodie hoodie kasonga.
Now, all these years later, the 89-year-old just retired chiropractor from Auburn, Washington, is going back to Japan on a new mission to resolve some old business. It has to do with this. During the war in the Pacific, many soldiers collected mementos from the battlefield, flags especially.
The flag is basically about 2.5 feet long and maybe a foot and a half wide like this. Has a red rising sun in the middle of it, and then has all this Japanese writing all around it and everything else.
Britt's war prize was so common, it has an English name, a good luck flag. It was a personal item, a traditional send-off gift from family or co-workers to a Japanese soldier or sailor.
This flag was taken off of a dead soldier just to happen to be a souvenir that they picked up now.
Britt says he took the flag during a battle in 1945 that ousted the Japanese from the small island of Ieshima near Okinawa. He says he didn't understand until this summer the significance the flag might hold to the fallen soldier's family.
It's like taking, if you found a dead GI and taking his dog tags off him and being able to send it back to his parents. That's the only connection they would have with it, because you wouldn't know where he was buried or nothing else. And that, what a wonderful thing to be able to return it to these people and be able to get it back to their relatives.
Britt is joined on the repatriation mission by six other World War II combat veterans. Pearl Harbor survivor Ed Johan of Lincoln City, Oregon, says the group travels in the spirit of reconciliation.
I have no animosity towards any of those people. We all, their military and our military were just following orders, and we had no say-so of what our feelings didn't matter.
Between them, the seven veterans will deliver 70 war flags to high-ranking Japanese officials or priests in Tokyo.
I think it's a gesture that should be appreciated. by everyone.
A relatively new humanitarian nonprofit based in Astoria, Oregon, conceived this mission and gathered the flags from aging veterans or their children around the U.S. A Japanese-American couple, Rex and Keiko Zeke, co-founded the group Obon 2015. Rex Zeke says they could have just mailed the flags to a Japanese ministry, but they concluded hand delivery by former combatants would send a more powerful message.
We thought, when in history has there ever been a time when soldiers who were fighting against an enemy return 70 years later with items that were taken from the battlefield as souvenirs showing I captured and dominated this enemy, and now they are being returned with the sentiment of, here, we hope this brings closure.
The Zeeks picked their couriers from a list of healthy and mobile World War II vets. The list came from another nonprofit called Honor Flight Network. Zeke assumed the Defense Department would provide free transport and housing for the week-long trip to Tokyo, that based on early enthusiasm shown by military contacts stateside and in Japan. But the logistical support fell through at the 11th hour.
Keiko calls a bank and tries to get as much credit on her credit card. And we're just, because we had to make a choice, do we say, okay, the military says they won't support us? Do we tell everybody it's over? Or do we try to make it happen? And we are trying to make it happen.
So far, the Zeeks have charged more than $40,000 in plane tickets alone. They estimate the total trip will cost $60,000 to $80,000. A friend has set up a crowdfunding site to raise money. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bonsi.
My dad was at Guadalcanal. He would have loved this. To help, go to hereandnow.org. From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.